Obama talks about war, Trump says Muslims no more, and we remember Bush v. Gore, all on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Homegrown terrorism reaches our shores, and our leaders are offering conflicting messages. How does this affect the American psyche?
There's lots and lots of research that talks about the different ways that these kinds of threats affect our attitudes and the kinds of political leaders we want.
Plus, gun control advocates fail in their latest attempts to make it tougher to purchase firearms. What, if anything, can Obama do?
The main thing that he is talking about doing is a proposal to define who constitutes a licensed gun dealer, sort of a backdoor way of broadening the background checks. So this is something that the president, the White House, says it is something they think they could do through his own authority without congressional action.
And we go back 15 years to the Supreme Court's ruling that decided the 2000 presidential election.
It's been a night of first giving it to Al Gore, then taking it away on the part of the networks. George Walker Bush, the new president of the United States.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 106 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. There are many interpretations of why President Obama chose a Sunday night in prime time to address the nation from the Oval Office. He needed to instill confidence in a nation that apparently has lost confidence in the administration's handling of the battle against ISIS. He wanted to warn against fear. He had a lot of work to do.
Tonight I want to talk with you about this tragedy, the broader threat of terrorism, and how we can keep our country safe.
He insisted that he has the right strategy for fighting ISIS, or ISIL, as he insists on calling the group. More bombings of Islamic State targets, more special operations forces in the region, more cooperation with countries who share our interests, including Turkey, whose open border has allowed ISIS to move in and out of the area. It was almost a stay the course kind of speech for a nation unconvinced that we are pursuing the right course. It's too soon to say if he changed any minds or reassured anybody. All we ask is for the president to keep us safe. And the killings in Southern California made many question if that is the case. Obama also called on Congress, again, to pass gun control legislation.
To begin with, Congress should act to make sure no one on a no-fly list is able to buy a gun. What could possibly be the argument for allowing a terrorist suspect to buy a semi-automatic weapon? This is a matter of national security. We also need to make it harder for people to buy powerful assault weapons, like the ones that were used in San Bernardino. I know there are some who reject any gun safety measures, but the fact is that our intelligence and law enforcement agencies, no matter how effective they are, cannot identify every would-be mass shooter, whether that individual is motivated by ISIL or some other hateful ideology. What we can do and must do, is make it harder for them to kill.
However, Obama's plea came 3 days after the Senate rejected two gun control measures. Clearly, that fight is not over. And the president also warned against lashing out at the Muslim community for the sins of a few.
We cannot turn against one another by letting this fight be defined as a war between America and Islam. That, too, is what groups like ISIL want. ISIL does not speak for Islam. They are thugs and killers, part of a cult of death. And they account for a tiny fraction of a more than a billion Muslims around the world, including millions of patriotic Muslim Americans who reject their hateful ideology. Moreover, the vast majority of terrorist victims around the world are Muslim. If we're to succeed in defeating terrorism, we must enlist Muslim communities as some of our strongest allies, rather than push them away through suspicion and hate.
That last plea was answered a day later by the Republican frontrunner for president.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Trump has pushed the envelope throughout the campaign, but this is the furthest he's gone in feeding off the suspicions about Muslims in this country. Or maybe it was just a way of his reacting to a Monmouth University poll of likely Iowa caucus attendees, which showed Ted Cruz now in the lead for the February 1st contest with 24%, followed by Trump with 19%, and Marco Rubio close behind at 17%. Whatever, Trump's proposal is just a part of a climate of unease, anxiousness, and uncertainty that is spreading in the country. We'll talk more about that later in the program. There's also a lot of unease and anger spreading in Chicago. Back in October of 2014, a white Chicago police officer shot a 17-year-old black man 16 times. That story wasn't revealed in its entirety until last month, when a judge ordered the police video of the killing to be released, a release the city had long resisted. In the past 2 weeks, the policeman was charged with first-degree murder, Mayor Rahm Emanuel fired the police chief, and many in the black community are demanding a civil rights investigation into the city's police department. And there are political problems for Emanuel as well. The mayor was re-elected last April, and there are accusations that the city sat on that police video to make sure it didn't become a campaign issue. But despite calls for his resignation by some in the civil rights community, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson, he said he would not do so. Here he is at a Monday news conference.
What do you say to those people in Chicago who are now questioning your leadership and your accountability and your credibility?
No. Well, look.
What do you say to people who think you're part of the problem, Mr.
One of the things that I have to do is I'm taking responsibility for what happened, and I take responsibility for fixing it in this action. And part of every level of government and service is thinking not only about the future of the city of Chicago, doing the things necessary, and making sure that you're held accountable for the results. And so I will be judged by that, as I was for the last 4 years and for the next 4 years, to make sure I do what's necessary and important for the city's future.
We'll see where that investigation leads. We do know that it leads to this week's trivia question. Of all the mayors from New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Philadelphia, who was the last to resign while in the middle of an ethics investigation? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it, bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday couldn't shut down.
There's been a lot of noise lately, a long string of loud voices and unpleasant things going on. Angry rhetoric from the presidential campaign. Unease over whether we can be kept safe. From terrorists, from guns, from madness. At some point, it has to take a toll on us. Matt Motel is an assistant professor in the social and personality area of the psychology department at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I have to say that you are not the typical guest we have on the Political Junkie. These are not typical times. We went through something similar after 9/11, but now it seems it's coming at us from every angle. Now, first, do you agree that we are in some kind of funk? And second, how similar or different is it from September 11, 2001?
Well, following the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, Americans are thinking more about terrorism than we probably have at any point since the months after 9/11. And Americans are more fearful right now, and rightfully so. It's terrifying to think that our neighbors could be stockpiling assault weapons and pipe bombs so that they might use them to launch an attack in our neighborhoods or at our workplaces. And given the media coverage of this, it's not surprising that we're thinking a lot about this and it's affecting our attitudes and our engagement, the campaigns.
You know, throughout the long and costly Vietnam War, as awful as it was, there was never the thought of, let's say, the Viet Cong coming into this country with suicide squads. I know that in the 1950s, there was a fear of a Soviet atomic attack. Remember all those bomb shelter drills. But But until 9/11, it never really materialized here. And now, as you say, with San Bernardino, the fear of homegrown terrorists, we have that too, and we never had that before.
Yes, and it makes everything more personal because it's here. It's not us thinking about some far-off country and people that look differently attacking maybe our military bases or people that we know but aren't right here. Now it seems that we could be attacked in our workplace or at our schools. Just this week, I received a video telling me what to do if somebody shows up with weapons and starts shooting up my school.
When you point out, I mean, that they've had these attacks at schools, at a movie theater, at restaurants, at holiday celebration. I guess the question is, one, who is safe or who could be considered safe? And really, what does that do to the American psyche?
Well, one of the curious things is that it's highly unlikely that any of us will ever succumb to or be a victim of these terror attacks on American soil. Just the probability of those happening is very low. We're much more likely to die from, say, high blood pressure or in a car accident than we are from terrorists attacking a coffee shop or our school. So even though the odds are very low, we're very fearful of it because it's so visceral, it's so powerful when you see these images or hear these stories. And there's lots and lots of research that talks about the different ways that these kinds of threats affect our attitudes and the kinds of political leaders we want, what we want from our government.
Well, speaking of political leaders, then you have a candidate like Donald Trump who talks about, you know, Obama's going to let in all these Syrian refugees and some Islamic terrorists are going to sneak in along with them. And that starts to weigh on people's minds. They get anxious.
Right. So our political views and behaviors are really strongly tied to our emotions and our gut feelings. Stephen Colbert calls that truthiness. I feel it in my gut. And that there's a lot of truth to that. Anxiety isn't exactly the feeling I would say that Trump is cultivating. I think he's cultivating more fear and the sense of threat. And past research shows that when people start feeling anxious, they don't like the person making them anxious. So I don't think that's exactly what Trump is doing. And that wouldn't really explain why he's become so popular. But there was a lot of research done on President Bush in the mid-2000s showing that when President Bush said things that made them anxious, they liked him less. They liked his policy positions less. But when he made them fearful or people perceived more threat in the things that he was talking about, say Osama bin Laden putting out a new video, people started supporting President Bush more and his policy preferences more. And you could see this time link where when the terror alert level would increase, people would support Bush more. They would support Patriot Act provisions more. And I think that the rhetoric that was used in the 2004 campaign is similar to the rhetoric being used in the Republican primary in 2015. Trump especially he's really good at stoking people's fears and promising them that he can alleviate them. Consistent with lots of this research, this might explain why Trump's poll numbers have been so high and robust following all of the terrible events that have happened in recent months.
Yeah, I see your point completely about the difference between anxiety. You're right, it's not so much resulting in anxiety, it is promoting fear. You were quoted in the New York Times talking about Trump's use of us versus them. And them, they, are either evil or crazy or stupid or losers. So another question, does that make people feel good about themselves or does it increase the hostility or both?
Well, I think the answer is both. When people talk in terms of us versus them, it does a couple things. The first thing it does is it really builds team support. So it connects my supporters to each other and to the mission that we're all working towards, making America great again, if we're using Trump's campaign. So by bonding people together, it's kind of rallying the troops, saying, okay, we're on one team, we're on the side of good, and now there is this evil, nefarious group over there, this scary group that is different, they don't think like us, they're stupid, they're evil, they're crazy maybe, they're immoral, and every time I talk about them, whoever they are, I'm motivating the people on my side to connect together, say, okay, it's really important that we bond together, we turn out the polls, we support our candidate, and we fight these evil, nefarious forces that are working behind the scenes.
I mean, yes, we do feel better about ourselves because we're uniting behind us, but when we castigate them, you know, the people who look different or speak different or sound different, it also defines us in a way that we haven't been defined before and not in a healthy way.
So talking in these very threatening ways is a very strategic thing to do. And when people are reminded of these existential threats, we become more nationalistic, We become more hostile towards people who look differently from ourselves. We become more likely to vote for charismatic candidates, even if they lack experience handling foreign policy, which seems particularly relevant. And we become more willing to forego civil liberties if we think it's going to make us safer. So to the extent that a candidate is threatening us with, oh, the immigrants are coming across the border, or these refugees, they are actually ISIS members and they want to kill us, it can increase our support for things like having a national registry for all Muslims in America, or cutting off all Muslim immigration, even though that is at odds with our Constitution, kind of the sentiment of what America was founded upon.
What do you think happens? This is a hard question to answer, but what do you think happens to these people if Trump were to suddenly no longer be a candidate or fade from the role of frontrunner? Is there a possibility that these people could become further isolated or disenchanted?
That's a very real possibility, because he's such a charismatic candidate, and his message is really very abstract, and it's saying, okay, you and I are going to make America great again, and everybody else is stupid or evil. And if he drops out, then the alternative is they have to support one of these people that they were previously saying was stupid or evil. So there's a very real possibility that they might just become disengaged from the process, be less likely to vote, be less interested, pay less attention, for sure.
Matt Motel is an assistant professor in the social and personality area of the Psychology Department at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's on Twitter at Matt Motel, M-O-T-Y-L. Matt, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Two more recent shootings to add to the list, at a Planned Parenthood facility in Colorado Springs, and at a holiday gathering in San Bernardino. These shootings, like earlier ones in Aurora, Newtown, Charleston, and elsewhere, were followed by predictable events. President Obama and many Democrats calling for stronger gun control legislation, Republican leaders in Congress, as well as the party's presidential candidates, calling for more mental health treatment, but refusing to back down on gun bills before Congress. You almost know what everyone is going to say in advance. Eric Lischblau is a reporter with the New York Times based in Washington. Eric, thanks for being on the program.
Pleasure.
You know, I say it seems like we know exactly what's going to happen word for word every time there's a mass shooting in America. We know what the president is going to say, we know what the gun control people are going to say, and we know what the Republicans and the gun rights people will say. So nothing seems to change.
No, you're right. It does feel very, very predictable, especially as we've seen this real flurry of shootings the last few months. The rhetoric has gotten more heated, but you can pretty much script out the arguments from both sides.
Earlier in the program, we heard President Obama in his Sunday night primetime address to the American people once again urge Congress to take action on passing legislation that would make it tougher for people to get guns. Let me play it one more time.
To begin with, Congress should act to make sure no one on a no-fly list is able to buy a gun. What could possibly be the argument for allowing a terrorist suspect to buy a semi-automatic weapon? This is a matter of national security. We also need to make it harder for people to buy powerful assault weapons, like the ones that were used in San Bernardino. I know there are some who reject any gun safety measures, but the fact is that our intelligence and law enforcement agencies, no matter how effective they are, cannot identify every would-be mass shooter, whether that individual is motivated by ISIL or some other hateful ideology. What we can do, and must do, is make it harder for them to kill.
Eric, you know that the president spoke 3 days after the Senate rejected a pair of gun control measures. One called for the universal background checks for those purchasing guns over the internet and the gun shows, and the other was for banning gun purchases for those who are on the no-fly list. But why didn't the president make his speech before the Senate votes?
I think he was clearly timing the announcement after the San Bernardino attacks, where this has become, you know, not just a problem in Paris and not just a problem in Colorado, but at a much higher level here in the United States, with a terrorism attack that was carried out by through semi-assault rifles. You know, this was an unusual moment for him, only his fourth Oval Office address as president. So I think he saw this as really elevating the game.
But, I mean, the Republicans will make the argument that, like, one reason they voted the no-fly legislation down is that some people are on the list mistakenly, and thus it wouldn't be fair if they lost their right to purchase guns. I think Marco Rubio said that it's a waste of time because no terrorist on a no-fly list is going to walk into a gun store and purchase a weapon. So the Republicans have their argument, and they don't seem to be changing on that either.
Sure, but I think this is an issue that the Democrats think that they can use at the very least to their political advantage, that the San Bernardino attacks have raised the stakes, and while their chances of actually succeeding may be only slight, they think that this is politically advantageous, more so than it was just a week or so ago.
Well, here's a question that just jumps at me right away. I mean, if Congress didn't pass gun legislation after 26 school children and staffers were murdered in Sandy Hook, or after parishioners were killed in Charleston, why would they do it now?
That's an excellent question. You certainly have folks on the left, among the gun control advocates, who ask that same question, who say that, you know, what could be more horrible than the murders at Newtown of kindergartners, and yet the closing the gun show loophole and background checks failed even then. So this attack in San Bernardino is a bit more muddled in some ways because it's not our traditional gun rampage, if you will, because it injects the added aspect of terrorism. So, but you're right. If it didn't happen after Newtown, it seems unlikely that it will happen at any point in the foreseeable future.
What's the argument against background checks for purchases at gun shows? Why is that different than buying guns in a store?
Well, one of the arguments is that these are sort of weekend gun enthusiasts, collectors, mom and pops, you know, who are not professional, who are not making a living as gun dealers. They should not be subjected to the same checks as a result of that. That's the main argument that you hear. The broader issue is that this is, you know, further unnecessary regulation in the view of the NRA guns of a Second Amendment right that would further restrict the ability of people to buy firearms of all sorts. Obviously, if it were up to the NRA, there would be a rolling back of the existing gun restrictions. So they wouldn't accept increased regulation without obviously a strenuous fight.
Every time Congress doesn't do something about these shootings or doesn't pass any further gun laws, we keep hearing, well, the NRA is powerful and they own all these lawmakers. But it's not that simple, is it?
Well, it's certainly true that the NRA has strong and influential role in Washington. They are a powerful lobbyist. They are have a big fundraising base that contributes tens of millions of dollars to lawmakers. Is it more complicated than that? Sure. But in Washington, a lot of it does come down to money.
But if you look at polls, when it comes to guns, I think voters who strongly support gun rights are more likely to be single-issue voters than those who support gun control. So when you see a horrific event like Newtown or San Bernardino or something like that, while the president may try to make an emotional appeal to the American people, it seems like the people who react most strongly to these kind of appeals are the people who support gun rights.
I think that is true by and large, that the folks on the right are more passionate about protecting their guns than the folks are on the left about trying to restrict them. And, you know, it's never been a particularly successful effort to run on gun control in Washington. You know, going back to 1994 and the original assault weapons ban on through the 2000 election, you know, the lesson for Democrats has been that you run on gun control at your own risk.
The president has often talked about taking executive action to bypass Congress when lawmakers refuse to act on his request. What can he do legally on this front?
Well, the main thing that he is talking about doing that we wrote about just a few days ago in the Times is a proposal to define who constitutes a licensed gun dealer, to somehow give that either a number or a more specific description, number of guns sold, for instance, per month or per year, or to impose standards such as whether or not you have your own website, whether or not you have a bricks and mortar shop or not, and bring more people under the tent as licensed gun dealers, which would be sort of a backdoor way of broadening the background checks. So this is something that the president at the White House says it is considering. It's something they think they could do through his own authority without congressional action. But, of course, if they did take that step, and it still has not been decided yet, obviously the NRA is almost certain to sue. You will have members of Congress who will challenge it and who will, again, accuse the president of acting by fiat, as they did with immigration and other matters.
The opponents can accuse the president all they want, but if this issue is that important to the president, he has just about a year left in his term. He doesn't have much time to get this done.
He does not have much time, but they have to worry about the courts, though. With immigration, when the president took steps on his own authority by executive action to give protected status to some 5 million undocumented workers, the courts have now found, and an appellate court has now found, that he did act outside his own authority. So if he were to go down that road again, I think he's more concerned probably about the legal risk than the political risk, and not wanting to get crosswise with the courts again. But no, there are several different proposals that they're said to be considering that would see what wiggle room there is within the enforcement and executive authority to take action in the absence of Congress doing anything.
I read that every time there's gun violence, and after each time the president says Congress must do something, gun purchases, legal gun purchases, go through the roof. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't know about every time, but certainly we saw that just in the last few weeks. That is a recurring phenomenon, I guess you'd call it. There is a lot of business being made out of at least stoking the fears that the government is about to take away your guns. And that has been a pattern that we've seen politically over the years, not just with Obama, but going back 20, 30 years.
I know there are gun control lawmakers who've given up offering any kind of bill because they know it won't pass in Congress. If that's the case, I hate to put this in political terms, but why does Obama continue to call for Congress to do something when it's clear the votes are not there? Has it become a political issue? Is he hoping it becomes a political issue?
Oh, I think he clearly wants this to be a political issue, and he's basically said as much, that he's really appealing directly to the voters as much as to members of Congress. And, you know, there is some indication that the public might be more persuaded than it was a few mass shootings again. So I think that's clearly the calculation. He does not have a whole lot of hope that without a change in the membership of the House or the Senate that he's going to get something through Congress, but I think he's appealing directly to the voters.
Eric Lischblau is a reporter with the New York Times based in Washington. He's on Twitter at Eric Lischblau, ERICLICHTBLAU. Eric, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, since 1976, what candidate of either party finished the lowest in Iowa and went on to win the nomination? The answer, John McCain. The Republican nominee in 2008, McCain finished fourth in that year's Iowa caucuses, behind Mike Huckabee, Mitt Romney, and Fred Thompson. And the randomly selected winner is Amy Greer of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Amy gets the coveted political junkie button. Don't forget, we still have a scuttlebutton puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more, on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. The 2000 presidential race was one of the closest in American history. But the networks were able to call it on election night, especially when they thought Vice President Al Gore defeated Governor George W. Bush in Florida. Here's NBC's Tom Brokaw.
We're going to now project an important win for Vice President Al Gore. NBC News projects that he wins the 25 electoral votes in the state of Florida. It turns out that Governor Jeb Bush was not his brother's keeper. The family had been joking, and seriously, that it could be a cold Thanksgiving.
That call by NBC didn't last long.
What the networks give us, the networks taketh away. NBC News is now taking Florida out of Vice President Gore's column and putting it back in the too close to call column.
And later that evening, Brokaw interrupted Doris Kearns Goodwin with some breaking news.
Oh, well, just there's no question that in a time of peace and prosperity like this, it's possible
for
the country to
Stop.
Have such
Doris,
a division
Doris,
as
Doris,
they do.
Doris, Doris, Doris.
Uh-oh, something's happened.
George Bush is the president-elect of the United States. He has won the state of Florida, according to our projections. 25 electoral votes. NBC News projects that George Bush, it's been a night of first giving it to Al Gore, then taking it away on the part of the networks. George Walker Bush, the new president of the United States.
Not long afterwards, there was a Gore concession, and then there wasn't.
All right, we're officially saying that Florida is too close to call because of a recall. Campaign and voter counters are being called back to work to count absentee ballots. So we take Florida away from George W. Bush. That means he is short of the 270 electoral votes that he needs to win.
After a mandatory machine recount, Bush's lead had slipped from nearly 1,800 to 327 out of some 6 million votes cast. What followed was weeks of partial recounts, Florida court decisions that went both ways, and partisan back and forths, until the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, halted the statewide recount. It left Bush with a 537-vote lead, and it made him the 43rd president of the United States. It was 15 years ago this week. Bruce Ackerman is a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University and the editor of Bush v. Gore, The Question of Legitimacy. Bruce, welcome to The Political Junkie.
It's a pleasure being here. And I want to emphasize that this fiasco that we're about to talk about can occur very easily next year. We have done nothing fundamental to transform the super politicized and amateurish way in which we run elections in the United States.
You know, we were told that after the 2000 election that the lesson learned was that we will never let this happen again, that the way we count, the way we do these things will be somehow reviewed and updated. That didn't happen, did it?
Well, there was a statute which didn't do much. But notice, I mean, just to give you a sense of how serious a problem this is, Catherine Harris, who is the Secretary of State, was at the same time co-director of the committee to elect George Bush in Florida.
So the person who was the gatekeeper, the person counting the votes, was also a Bush campaign official.
She should have recused herself.
And so apparently we have secretaries of state in states around the country who are either partisan Democrats or Republicans.
That's right. And you see, because in many states, secretaries of state are elected.
Well, let me go back to the Supreme Court decision, because there have been court decisions that have split the nation in two, but I can't think of one or a controversial one like this that was seen in such partisan terms.
Now, of course, I should emphasize, because most of your listeners won't know it, I was representing Al Gore before the Florida State Legislature at the time this decision was announced. So I very much try, I really do, to make a big distinction between my public interest lawyer activities and my views as a constitutional lawyer. I really do try. But I do want to emphasize that, that I was involved in this case. But from as much of an impartial view as I can muster on this, as with 15 years of experience, the fundamental problem was this. It was not the Supreme Court's decision that we really have a serious problem of integrity with the Florida process, that the Supreme Court of Florida had to have much more elaborate guidelines to regulate the recount. That is was a perfectly plausible decision. The thing that was not plausible was that the court said, we can't have a recount. December 12th is it. There was no basis in Florida law for saying that they couldn't have had a recount for the next 3 weeks.
There had to be a legal argument for the court to get involved in some way, the U.S. Supreme Court. What was their legal argument?
Yes, there is a legal argument for considering whether the process that Florida was pursuing was consistent with the Equal Protection Clause.
Of the 14th Amendment.
And this is the thing that distinguishes this case from many controversial cases. There was no legal argument for stopping the recount. That was a shocker. A genuine shocker.
When you think of some cases of national importance, like the Brown decision.
Completely.
Or the case against President Nixon, the court ruled unanimously. So when you have a 5-4 decision with the 5 so-called conservatives voting to end the recount and the 4 so-called liberals voting to continue the recount, that's to me, that sounds political.
Well, but mind you, you see, we have, let's take a decision with which I very much disagree on the merits, invalidating the voting key provisions of the Voting Rights Act a couple of years ago. That decision, however much I disagree with it, was generated in a 5-4 way. but the opinions were thoughtful, you know? And there is, you know, on many fundamental and divisive questions, there are reasonable things to be said on both sides, and it's a matter of judgment. Taking December 12th and just pushing it in there so you could stop the recount was not, it's just not one of those things, you know, like that's like rule, you know, it's either in there or not. And especially given the political stuff going on by the Secretary of State, it would have, redeemed the democratic process to get an honest count. And we never have had, we don't know who won in Florida to this day.
We were taught, or as a kid, I was taught that the court was above partisan politics. How do you, in your opinion, how do you think the court's decision affected how people now see the court?
Well, you see, the sad truth is, you know, if we look at public opinion polls, the court suffered a hit in the short run. There was a little honeymoon for George Bush when he gets in, and then he had 60% when he's inaugurated, then it starts sinking down to 50. Things were not looking good. I hate to say it, but the thing that saved the Supreme Court from a really serious hit was Osama bin Laden. On September 11th, 2001, all of this was yesterday.
And basically legitimized George W. Bush as president.
Completely. You know, everyone, I was among them. You know, everyone rallied to the flag. This was not a time to continue these partisan debates, you know?
Except for some recent decisions on same-sex marriage and Obamacare, the left seems more angry about the court than the right does And the Citizens United case is a good example. Let me play a piece of tape from Obama's 2010 State of the Union message, which the Democrats loved.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
There's a famous scene of Justice Samuel Alito shaking his head during this. Do you remember a president ever attacking the court during such an address?
Well, of course, the great precedent in all this is Franklin Delano Roosevelt and court packing.
But not during a State of the Union address.
Not during a State of the Union address, but he was he spoke to the country on radio, and that was very dramatic at the time.
Let me just end by going back to that 2000 decision again by the Supreme Court and asking you, do you feel that there is lasting suspicion of the Supreme Court today that it's become partisan, just like the White House, just like Congress?
Yes. I know I had a conversation when Justice Scalia visited Yale. We were talking together, and he said, get over it. And it would have been easy to get over it, and in a certain sense, as I said, given Osama bin Laden, we did get over it. But this rat-tat-tat of 5-4 opinions on hotly contested matters is bad for the country.
Bruce Ackerman is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University and the editor of Bush v. Gore, The Question of Legitimacy. Bruce, thanks for being on the program.
A pleasure. Good talking to you.
It was 15 years ago this week, on December 12, 2000, that the U.S. Supreme Court ordered a halt in the recount of the presidential race, essentially making George W. Bush the president-elect. The day after the ruling, Al Gore conceded the race. For good.
Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken. Let there be no doubt, while I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. I accept the finality of this outcome, which will be ratified next Monday in the Electoral College. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. We want to let you know that next week, we'll be bringing you our annual Political Junkie Remembrances special. We'll be remembering many of the political newsmakers, journalists, and public servants who passed on this year. And we'd also love to hear from you. We invite you to share any fond memories that you have of notable political figures who left us in 2015. Just call our voicemail box at 316-KEN-9646. That's 316-536-9646. And leave a message with your thoughts and memories. We may share them on next week's program. But I can't end this week's program without a personal note. I'm sad to report that my old friend from ABC News, Bob Clark, has died. He was 93. Bob was an absolute national treasure. He started at ABC covering the Eisenhower administration. He was in Dallas when President Kennedy was assassinated. He had one of the last interviews with Robert Kennedy and was also in Los Angeles when Bobby was killed. He was one of the funniest, kindest, sweetest, generous men I've ever met. And he was so good to me, this newbie who walked into the ABC News Bureau in Washington for the first time in 1986. He and Herb Kaplow, another legend who passed several years ago, always went out to lunch together, but every now and then Bob would say, "Let's bring the kid." And they did. I can't begin to express what a wonderful human being he was. A full life at 93. Rest in peace, Bob. You were the best. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You could also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you could follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.